This was introduced by the House Co-Chair, Representative Hanley. It seems very straightforward in dealing with certificates of participation and lease-type financing. I believe that I certainly support the intent of the legislation and believe that it's simple enough that we can be sure that it does that. Are there any questions? Do we have a sign-up sheet on this bill? We need to check that.
54?
183.
Oh, 183. Want me to go get Kip?
No.
Mr. Chairman,
is there a sign-up sheet on the bill?
I'll move the bill and we'll just hold it.
Okay, no, we'll go ahead and move it. I just want to make sure that we have it scheduled for today, so it's scheduled and noticed. I just want to make sure that there wasn't somebody other than a staff member signed up to testify that because our schedule is so up in the air, didn't get here to say their piece. Okay, Senator Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, I move CSHB, 183 Finance, out of committee. Next one, Finance with the company zero fiscal note.
Okay, we have a motion to move out committee substitute for House Bill 183, it's House Finance, with individual recommendations and the accompanying zero fiscal note. Do we have anyone signed up to testify other than the staff?
No.
Thank you. Are there objections to moving the bill? Without objection, the bill is moved out with individual recommendations and the fiscal note. There's a rule against retroactive questions.
Randy, you want to give him a copy of the four amendments? Copy of the four amendments.
Four amendments, yeah. We just kill diligence.
That brings us back on our schedule to Senate Bill 54.
Mr. Chairman, you need a moment.
Well, Senator Frank was interested in Senate Bill 54. I don't know that I agreed with his interest, but let's see. We have
just one fiscal.
The Labor and Commerce CS is the later CS.
So we amended it.
Let's see if we can locate Senator Frank.
Can you remember why the commission opposed this? My notes are up here.
They like the amendments.
I regret the memory.
Have we offered all the amendments that the commission was concerned with?
Yes.
We have?
The two that I was willing to offer. I believe, Mr. Chairman, they also wanted exemption from the procurement code, and I was not prepared to sponsor that amendment.
Now, they had an amendment on
we took care of the terms so that there wouldn't be any problem with new governors, and we allowed them to exempt their two special assistants as partially exempt employees. Other than that, the only other request that I was aware of that was all in one letter was the exemption from the procurement code.
Yeah, they wanted an exemption for their hearing officers or their expert witnesses.
Expert witnesses. I saw that. Limited to that. I don't have a problem with that.
Bob Lohr, on. He wanted to be on. Do I have the rest of the We're on 54. This is not as complete a folder as I had before, wherever my other folder is. Do we have an amendment proposed by the commission? A specific amendment on hearing officers?
Which
yes are you working on?
Labor and Commerce.
Labor and Commerce. Yes, that's what I'm talking about. Purchasing. Did Bob Lohr want to testify or just answer questions?
They sent us the facts that I believe they probably wanted to speak to.
Well, the facts is just the testimony of Don Ferrer.
They serve 6-year terms? Do they serve 6-year terms on that commission?
Yeah, 6 years.
Mr. Hutchins, did you have any more testimony on this bill? Or?
1031, one minute. Two.
Testimony, Mr. Chairman. The information you had the other day, there was an amendment prepared by the commission on the exemption from the procurement code that you mentioned that was available here. They talked about having another amendment. That was what I was expecting to see in the facts that came down, but it was really just some more testimony. Just restating the position a different way.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I picked my two amendments out of a one-page letter that recommended three. And ask for further information on the exemption for expert witnesses. And
okay.
I guess the testimony that I did today was that. I didn't get any more detail.
Okay, the request is an amendment to the Procurement Act 363850, which would allow contracts for professional services or testimony related to proceedings before the commission, including procurement pursuant to 4205111. Their statement is this is modeled after an existing exemption provided to the Department of Law. Basically for the same type of situations. If someone would choose to offer that amendment, we could incorporate it into... Yes?
I could do it conceptually.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we amend the bill to allow the commission to hire expert witnesses and to be exempt from the procurement code, to enable them to do it without procurement code restrictions.
Does everybody understand that amendment? It's being drafted. Why don't we just wait till it comes back? But the question is that they can't get, or their statement is they can't get expert witnesses and go through the procurement process to get them in a timely fashion to have them be able to use. And there is a similar exemption in the Department of Law when they use the same kind of situations. Anybody else have any information on that beyond that? Senator Rieger?
I have a question. Would, in the case of proceedings before the APUC where an expert witness would be called in, is the cost of the expert witness placed upon the regulated utility? I guess, are they in teleconference?
I don't know if they're on or not.
Oh, they're not.
Anybody,
okay.
Did anybody call Bob Lord?
I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I don't know what the current regulations are, but in the past, the utility was assigned the cost of the total regulatory hearings. Now, how that has changed in the last 9 years, I'm not sure, since we put in the assessment on utilities to pay for all the commission costs, but I still think special tariff costs relating to a hearing is assignable to the utilities if the commission so chooses to assign it. That's their choice.
But I think that it's reasonable to not go through the Procurement Act to contract for a unique expert witness, although I think that you have without the exemption from the Procurement Act, you have the ability to skirt it by saying this is a unique service that you need, and therefore you aren't going out to bid. But my main concern is that sometimes when we see the detail of some of our legal cases, expert witness fees can be really high, and I'm worried about this. I'm worried if this creates any kind of a blank check out of the utility's pocket for thousands of dollars, you know. I don't know if the Procurement Act is really going to make the difference in that, but I'm wondering if somehow we're kind of encouraging that kind of practice.
I don't know the answer to that question. Senator Phillips?
Basically the same concern as Senator Rieger. Why is this agency so different from the others that require an exemption from the Procurement Act?
I think, have you got the copy of the...
Yeah, I'm looking at it, but I'm not.
If it is not a compelling argument to the members of the committee, then obviously it won't get added to the bill. My only effort was to be sure that it was brought forth because it was requested by the commission to be put on the table. Senator Sharp, did you move the amendment? Or?
Well, I moved the amendment.
Did you move the amendment?
Yes, I did.
I thought you had. Senator Jarrow?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, I don't know that much about the workings of the commission on how they actually function and how they get to their calling of expert witnesses, but I don't, and if there is some coordination, if the utility has to pay for that, whether they work that out ahead of time or whatever, but the procurement code has caused some problems in being able to get the expert witnesses in a timely manner. We're hearing similar concerns now with ASME, if you'll just let me diverge just a little bit. You know, they are looking to get some sort of exemption from the procurement code as well because of the contracts there that they have to deal with and the timeliness and being able to deal with the contractors or subcontractors in advertising. And in some cases, you just don't have that flexibility in the state. So I would probably go with the judgment of the commission on this case here. And certainly I would guess if we find that they are causing utilities and consumers an undue cost at some point, that things would change very quickly.
Thank you, Senator Sharp. Further debate, Senator Sharp.
I would just say that in all the tariff cases I've been involved in, there is a lot of lead time from the time the tariff is filed and the hearing is set by the commission. That's their latitude. And I don't know how long it takes for procurement, but I can't imagine it takes much over 90 days to 120 days, and these things go on for 6 months to a year. So, you know, the compelling evidence, that's why I didn't introduce the amendment to begin with. It seemed to me there's a lot of time from the time that they know they're going to have a hearing until they can get the witnesses on board. They testified it was a problem. I was willing to let them justify it, but frankly, if they're not available, I'm not convinced.
Do we have Bob Lohr online?
Yes,
Okay, the question before the committee is the exemption to the Procurement Act for expert witnesses. If you could address that question with the justification, I would appreciate it.
That is to Bob Lohr.
Do we have Bob Lohr on the...
Yes, sir, Senator. This is Bob Lohr, and John Schroer is on his way over here also.
Would you address the need for an exemption from the Procurement Act for the services of expert witnesses?
Yes, I'd be glad to do that. The Alaska Public Utilities Commission, over the years, I'm trying to find the part in the testimony yesterday, has run into problems in procuring expert witnesses timely. When the commission sets a deadline in the dockets, the deadline set typically does not allow time for a successful bidder to be put in place unless the proceeding is to be delayed 90 to 120 days to allow for the normal procurement process to occur. And the choice there is between regulatory lag of delaying regulatory decisions in order to allow the expert witnesses to be hired and put in place and thereby complying with the full-blown Procurement Act requirements, or to seek more expedited basis for getting the consultants in place. And it's for this limited purpose of when the commission needs an expert witness for staff as a party to the proceeding that we would request that exemption. It is not for the day-to-day procurement that we do for all kinds of normal Procurement Act requirements where we would still follow the normal rules.
Senator Sharp.
Thank you. Mr. Lohr, what is the normal time lag from the time you set a docket on a tariff filing and give public notice and give the utilities notice of when they should have their stuff submitted for review by the commission and then set later for the commission staff to reply and then have the public hearing? What's the average time on that currently?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sharp, I'll have to get a typical docket schedule to look at it, but it's going to vary with the complexity of the proceeding. Normally, the commission is going to put out a notice and give 30 days to the public to comment on a proceeding before anything else happens. And while that's happening, the commission will be preparing a procedural order in order to set a schedule for the hearing. The actual deadlines in that schedule are going to vary with the complexity of the proceeding and how much the time the utility indicates that it needs to be prepared. Normally, once the utility deadline is set, then 30 days thereafter, the commission staff must file its reply testimony, and that is the time when the expert witness's actual results, their work product from the contract, are needed. And in order for that to happen, if the procurement process is still going on, of course, they can't be doing the work necessary to produce it. But I'll try to get you a more firm answer on the average length of time for each of those steps.
The other question that came up through the chair was, before you came online, was what's a normal procedure for who pays for the cost of those expert witnesses, and could it be a factor? I'll defer to Senator Rieger. That was his concern.
Senator Rieger.
Bob, you probably heard the question. Who pays the cost of an expert witness most often in these proceedings?
Typically, at this time, the regulatory cost charge, which is collected from utilities and typically passed through to customers of those utilities, pay for that expert witness. However, there is a provision that would allow the commission to assign those costs to other parties to a proceeding that might not be paying the regulatory cost charge so that it would be fair. But normally those consultant costs would be paid by the regulatory cost charge, the commission's source of funding for its operating budget.
Okay.
Senator Rieger.
The other question I have is, do the expert witnesses that you have hired or contemplate hiring, would their billings in the aggregate probably be less than $25,000?
No. Senator, Mr. Chairman, the typical expert witness contract is considerably higher than that. They range anywhere from $35,000 on up to probably a maximum in the range of $150,000.
So that's why you can't use small procurements, I see.
That's correct.
And why are you not using 36-33-10 emergency procurements where it says that you can only get around the Procurement Act when to do so would be impracticable or contrary to the public interest?
I'm not sure I understood the complete question. This would not constitute an emergency, although it can be a major inconvenience to the utility and to the conduct of the case. The impracticability clause, I think the commission is caught a bit between a rock and a hard spot in wanting to expedite the proceeding to get the decision made. But I don't know that that in itself constitutes impracticability in the eyes of the state procurement officers.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure, you know, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with a blanket release from the Procurement Act, and I'm not sure if I'm reading 36-33-10 right. It does have that clause in there, but I'm not sure if that's in conjunction with a threat to public health, welfare, or safety, or is that is an alternative trigger which allows you to use 36-33-10.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rieger, we've discussed this provision with the Department of Administration and the Chief Procurement Officer and considered various options that might be available for trying to get temporary relief to get witnesses on more timely. And impracticability was not one of the options that he suggested.
Questions by members of the committee? We have a motion to adopt the language contained in this memo would be an additional section. Senator Jaroff.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is by going around the, or by not following the procurement code, is it a cost savings, or does it cost about the same amount of money to get an expert witness, or is it more the time delay, or what is the other than the time delay, is there a financial incentive to do it this other way?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jaroff, there may be a financial incentive in that under the current method, when we finally get a consultant on board, we really have to have them work quickly, truly expedite their work, and that means that the staff here, the project director, has to do the same. When they come up for a hearing, typically, they're going to be working that entire weekend before the hearing, getting ready for the case to put on. That type of crunch to prepare would be much more manageable if there were more time to prepare. So there may be a cost savings there. It's hard to say exactly, but the primary purpose for this is to get the job done right, to get the best possible evidence put in front of the commission so that they can make the best possible regulatory decision, and that's a timing problem primarily.
Okay, is there further debate? If there's no further debate, all those in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. All those opposed? Amendment fails. That brings the bill back before us.
Senator Halford? Senator I'd like Frank. To make a motion to remove Section 3.
We have a motion to delete Section 3.
That's the garbage deregulation. Prohibition. I think we should just keep it status quo. I don't think there's much danger that they're going to run off and do something crazy. And I don't see any reason for them to have a special exception for refuse collection as far as
utility regulation. Just keeps it status quo, keeps it to the point where if they, for some reason, want to make a change, they could, without coming back and fighting something through the legislature. I don't know. They haven't pursued it in the past. Don't know that they would in the future. Don't know if I wouldn't expect them to. I guess. I don't see why we should give one more little special interest piece of legislation.
Question is the deletion of Section 3. As I stated, my concern is what municipalities do following that.
Well, sometimes they should just municipality. Mostly, we do try to let municipalities have some local option. If there's an issue, they'll have to deal with that, with the politics of that at the local level, I guess. And I would like to think that if they're doing something that would be grossly unfair to a private utility, that they would have to face the pressure of doing that at the local level. I mean, I'm sure that I guess I can't assume that the local elected people are going to be less sensitive to the issues than we would be. But.
Looks like Mr. Reinwand is jumping up and down back there wanting to testify on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jerry Reinwand. I represent the Alaska Refuge Utilities Association. Our concern, this amendment was added to the Labor and Commerce Committee, and I'd like to call the members' attention to the provision, Section 3 in the bill. Senator Frank, I understand your concern about perhaps singling out refuse for special treatment. Our preference would be to repeal 711D entirely for everybody. If you read 711D exemption as, if you read the language all except for the bold-faced language, which was the amendment that was added in Labor and Commerce, 711D basically says the commission can do whatever it wants to do in the way of exemptions anytime that it wants to if it deems it's in the public interest. The issue, and it pretty much was articulated by Senator Sharp vis-a-vis the issue of what is a certificate and what protection, quote-unquote, or what does that really mean? We think the public policy issue here on deregulation should be decided by the legislature, not the commission. We believe the 711D gives the commission, in effect, legislative authority. We think that's wrong. Of course, it's clearly up to the legislature to delegate its authority if it wants to do it. The only reason, Senator Frank, that the language was narrowed to refuse utilities was that the commission took a position opposing the total repeal of 711D, and while the commission has taken no stance itself, as I understand it, on just the exception for refuse here, Chairman Schreyer said that was acceptable to him personally. So that's how the language ended up the way it was. Our preference would be to repeal it for everybody and leave this clearly in the hands of the legislature.
Questions? Senator Rieger.
Yes, I'm wondering if Mr. Schreyer has made it to the teleconference yet. I thought I heard him vehemently oppose Section 3.
Hello, I'm here.
What was your position on Section 3?
On Section 3?
Yes.
Well, again, I would like to have 711D stay obviously in the statute because I'm not a great limit how we could do our work around here. But again, I agree that if solid waste is going to be deregulated, it should be done legislatively. I agree with that statement. Now, whether or not you're going to put that amendment in, that's a legislative decision. That's really not our decision to make.
Senator Phillips?
John, this is Randy Phillips. Did you have a concern about there was no definition of public interest? The very last two words of page one.
I didn't get that.
I said the last, I thought it was you that brought up the point that there was no definition in public interest on page one, the last two words.
No, I didn't. I'm not okay with that. I realize what you're saying, but it wasn't me that brought that up. We're trying to find a copy of it right now.
Who did? Somebody did bring it up.
Further questions? Senator Rieger.
Just I guess since my recollection is wrong, I was wondering, Mr. Schreier, what was it, if anything, that you had a strong statement about in this
whole
bill?
Was
it the whole bill you were against?
Yeah, the whole bill. We were, Senate Bill 54, our statement was we're opposed to the initial bill that was filed.
Okay.
Question before the committee is the adoption of Senator Frank's amendment. All those in favor, please raise your hand. All those opposed? The amendment fails to be adopted. Senator Sharp.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move CS for Senate Bill number 54, finance out of committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
There's a motion to move out committee substitute for Senate Bill 54 with individual recommendations and the accompanying fiscal note. Let's see, is that now as a that would be the finance CS, by the way, because we did adopt amendments. Are there objections? Without objection, the bill will go out of committee with individual recommendations and the fiscal note. Things to do for right now. Are we supposed to be downstairs?
Yeah, I've got a state affairs meeting. I'm supposed to be running around.
Do you want to come back in at all today?
What?
Nope.
So we can adjourn?
Just adjourn it. Adjourn it.
Okay. With that, the Finance Committee is adjourned until next Tuesday.
We're going to bring the meeting to order due to the press of time. People want to show up later, they can, I guess. I'd like to invite Commissioner Condon to join us, and my understanding is that you will lead off and then invite Annalee McConnell and Chuck Logsdon up to do their portions of the presentation. Appreciate your being here this morning, and I wish it was better news.
Well, I don't mind. Help us tighten our belts.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is, for the record, Wilson Condon, Commissioner of Revenue. I have a few brief introductory points I'd like to make. Obviously, the news, as you know, is that in relation to the November forecast for the mid-case case, the Department of Revenue has lowered its forecast for FY96 general fund revenue by $184 million. That reduction is based on the following factors. At the current time, we believe that North Slope production is going to be down from what we forecast in November by about 92,000 barrels a day. Our destination price forecast is down by 20 cents from 1672 to 1652 a barrel. And the transportation costs that determine what the state receives at the wellhead, we believe are going to be about 51 cents a barrel higher than what we saw in November. Over the next 5 years, as always, have presented a series of scenarios, a mid-case, high case, and a low case. And I'd like to emphasize that in some of those years, the state will probably achieve the high case, at least on the price and perhaps on the volumes. And in some years, it's likely to get the low case as well. We're looking at a range. Sometimes we'll do better, sometimes we'll do worse. But over the longer term, we believe that you should be planning around the series that you see as the mid-case. Right now, the price of ANS crude is over $18.50 a barrel, and our price forecast for FY96 is for $16.52. And so it very well may be that FY96 is going to be one of those high-case years. But in terms of looking at the basic market fundamentals over the next few years, we do not foresee a situation now where those market fundamentals are going to change dramatically, and those market fundamentals, we believe, call for a price in 1995 terms of roughly $16.50 a barrel. I'd like to make one last point on the volumes, and that is that, as you know, the Cambridge Research folks made their presentation here, and that was seen by folks as an optimistic set of production volume projections. And I'd only like to point out that in terms of our own projections, out through the year 2002, we share in either the optimism or the pessimism, depending on how you see it, of the Cambridge projection numbers. Our own volume production forecast actually exceeds the Cambridge forecast out through 2002 until they have in their materials had the bump up in production volumes. With that, I'll let Annalee proceed.
I thought it was well worth at least commenting briefly on how we view these projections relating to the FY96 budget. It seems like it would be rather irresponsible not to notice that there is some connection between the two. We do believe that this is one of the indicators of exactly why it is we need to have a much firmer fiscal plan for the state. But in getting to that point, we also think it doesn't make sense to make hasty actions which could have a negative effect on the overall state economy and on services that need to be provided. There are a couple of points that that we'll have to pay even more attention to throughout this year, one of which is exactly what's going on a month-by-month basis. We do have the opportunity for mid-year course corrections if that's necessary. We will keep an extremely close eye on this. We need to be proceeding with the development of our fiscal plan, working with the Long Range Fiscal Planning Commission. This is exactly the sort of thing that dramatizes why we need to have that kind of a policy, why we need to be sure we have the capability in the state to make adjustments and course corrections that don't drive us into the kinds of things we saw in 1986 with the state and local economies. We do believe that the track that we're on in terms of bringing the budget down from the amount that was originally proposed in February is the right direction, but that it would not be a good idea to take drastic action. I don't think anybody has proposed that we match the new revenue forecast with cuts of that magnitude. But I do want to reassure you that we intend throughout the year, not just at the period of setting the budget initially, but throughout the year, intend to keep a very close eye, work with departments, see where we're headed, stay in touch with the revenue forecasts, and as I say, make mid-course corrections as needed. So I don't see that this should change dramatically what happens in the budget process at this point, but obviously we're on the right track to be having some reductions from what was initially proposed. Turn it over to Chuck for the more detailed information for you on the forecasts themselves. Okay. If you'll excuse me, I'm going to be going to another hearing shortly, so unless there are any questions, Andy.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Logston with the Department of Revenue, a petroleum economist. Today, I was going to go over for you our latest forecast of revenues, and I did provide you with a handout that I want to use to try to explain some of the key features of the new forecast. The first page is really is an illustration of our new forecast. It shows for you graphically where we've been in general fund unrestricted numbers from 1990 through 94 and what our forecast looks like. I think now remembering that these are nominal dollars, and nominal dollars is just the money that we're going to get. This is not making any attempt to account for purchasing power or anything in nominal dollars. I think let me tell you what the numbers are for the short run, because I think that there's always a lot of interest in that. For fiscal 95, we are currently projecting we'll come in at $1.885 billion. I think with the higher oil prices, we'll probably be updating that number for you by roughly May 1, at least to try to, and if they stay as high as they are, I'm fairly confident we can probably bring in 1.9 in fiscal 95. But let's look at fiscal 96, because that's really where our biggest adjustment is from the fall forecast, looking at 1.77 billion, and then in 97, 1.828. That's you can see that in the graph by sort of a minor little dip, and then we move back up, and it looks like from the graph, we in our mid-case scenario, we feel fairly confident that in nominal dollar terms, that we can probably bring in something around $1.9 billion a year if production and price stay pretty close to that mid-case level. And let's take a look at those individual assumptions. On the second page, I guess if I were to characterize this forecast by one assumption, it is our production assumption. And we did make a fairly radical adjustment downward in our production estimates in the short term. Just to give you a little background, for the last several years, we'd been holding out a fairly optimistic projection for production out of Prudhoe Bay in fiscal 95 and 96. We had felt that there was a good chance with the commissioning of the GHX-2 project that the decline at Prudhoe Bay could be mitigated fairly significantly. That has, although we got a good bump up in production when the project first came online, it looks like after things have settled down, we just weren't going to be able to make all the oil that we thought we were going to be able to make out of Prudhoe Bay. So we had sort of a one-time adjustment downward in what we expected to be the producibility out of Prudhoe Bay. This was compounded by a lot of weather-related downtime and unplanned seasonal maintenance as well in the Prudhoe Bay oil field. That has basically resulted in a, the commissioner stated, about a 92,000 barrel a day decline in our production estimates for the total North Slope from our fall forecast. Let me move to some better, the good news. That's sort of the bad news, and we've kind of gotten it out of the way right up front by adjusting sort of the base that we're projecting off of. The good news is there is a lot of additional activity going on the slope. There's a very aggressive plan to expand the Milne Point development. We see that going up to about 50,000 barrels a day. It looks like the Milne Point facilities will finally be moving oil out to market at something closer to what the original plans suggested they would be. This is through a combination primarily of new discovery of new producible pay, which has been possible through technology and also additional exploration work. This is part of the good news of it. The other thing is we're looking at an additional enhanced oil recovery project at Kaparik, the LSEOR, I guess, large-scale enhanced oil recovery, where they'll be moving natural gas liquids through the Oliktok pipeline and from Prudhoe Bay, and using that to enhance the recovery of oil from Kaparik. This project will be adding some oil production from Kaparik. With the startup of more well drilling in both Kaparik and in Prudhoe Bay, we've actually, if you took our forecast decline curve for the North Slope, let me say, I guess to you guys, it'd be like this. In a way, we sort of took and pivoted it. We dropped it up front, but raised it in the back end like that, so that we see probably something like where before we had something like maybe, and I'm pulling this number kind of off the top of my head, but something in the 7% per year decline rate for that period between that the commissioner referred to between now and the year 2002. We're looking at decline rates for the entire slope of something closer to 4%. So just to repeat that, this production curve, if you kind of match that up with the revenue curve, you'll see that really what we've got is we've got a little bit of a downturn here in the next couple of years, but then we do anticipate moving back up to what I sort of think as over the next 5 or 6 years, something around a $1.9 billion a year general fund unrestricted number. Let's turn to another issue that jumped out at us when we made this adjustment in production, and that is the tax rate. As you know, the severance tax is subject to the economic limit factor, the rate. And the economic limit factor is a direct function of two things. How many barrels are you producing, and how many wells did it take to produce the oil? Well, as it turns out, when we drop our, if we keep our wells the same, or we drill a few more and we drop the oil production, on average, that lowers the amount of oil coming out of each well. And that's exactly what lowers the ELF. So as a matter of fact, we're going to, as you see in this graph, this is a graph of the actual North Slope production tax rate. And you can see that in fiscal 96, if you compare the 95 estimate with 96, or even compare 95 with 94, you see that the tax rate's beginning to come down. And it takes a fairly good size drop between 95 and 96. And a lot of that is a function of our pulling back some of that production out of off the slope. The other thing that's happening, of course, is that we have one field that's incredibly productive right now that's paying a lot of severance tax, and that's Point McIntyre. The reason why it's paying a good chunk of severance tax is because they're producing upwards of 140,000 barrels a day or more out of wells that are producing at 7,000-8,000 barrels a day. Very, very productive wells, so that the ELF is very close to, it's I think around 0.9. So they're paying very close to the maximum rate. In this forecast, we're assuming that in order to keep production at those kinds of levels, they may double the number of wells that are producing in that field. And with the resulting effect that the production stays the same, but our tax drops. And just to give you a little rule of thumb, how do you translate this declining production tax rate into dollars? Roughly every percentage point that the... Every 1% drop in the ELF cost at $10 a barrel wellhead cost us about $7 million. So that means that in this case, in 96, we're looking at something like nearly a 5% drop in the tax rate. So that's translates into something just a little, somewhere between 35 and 40 million. Let's turn to the next graph and look at our oil price forecast. Our oil price forecast is not really all that much changed from what we did last fall. In the short term, we did roll it back. I think in the fall we used like 1672 as our base case for fiscal 96. We rolled that back about 20 cents a barrel because at the time we were putting these numbers together, there was a very serious push by Iraq to get the embargo lifted, and it wasn't so much that it was Iraq that wanted the embargo lifted. Iraq has always wanted the embargo lifted. It was that they had two key allies on the Security Council, France and Russia, who were very interested in doing some work in the Iraqi oil sector, and were pushing quite hard to get it lifted. Well, as we all know, about two weeks ago, the UN's special, I don't know if he's a special envoy or his, well, anyway, his name's Ralph Achaeus. He's the man in charge of the UN effort to determine whether or not Iraq is in compliance with those conditions necessary to lift the embargo, came out and said, no, you can't lift the embargo. These guys are working on weapons of mass destruction. We haven't been able to look at facilities. It appears they're trying to establish a germ warfare capability or whatever. There was a little bit of news late last week that the UN had said, though, that they would okay a limited lifting of the embargo to allow the sale of up to $2 billion worth of oil to fund war reparations and provide food and medicine that the UN would be in charge of distributing to the Iraqi people. And apparently that was not going to work for Saddam, so that you know dropped oil prices, and now today they're back up again. In any event, our forecast of oil prices, I think the presentation you got from Cambridge a couple weeks ago is there. That worldview is very consistent with the one that we have. I don't want to really plow a lot of ground that they went over, but let me just focus on the things that we looked at when we put together our numbers. On the demand side, we see economic growth as probably being relatively robust over the next 5 years or so, and with the possible exception of Japan, which seems to be struggling, they seem to be the main party struggling with the effect of the dollar on their economy. The strong dollar is I think ultimately forcing the Japanese to look at some sort of structural transformation of their internal economy. But everywhere else in the world, economic growth is humming along at a good clip. We're year to year, we are increasing our consumption of oil at the rate of about I think last year world globally it was almost 2 million barrels a day. Consumption was up, almost up 2%, which would be somewhere in the neighborhood of 1.2, 1.4 million barrels a day of additional oil consumed every day. Of that, OPEC picked up a little less than half. Non-OPEC picked up the lion's share, and that sort of leads us to the supply side. We think that, obviously on the supply side, you're looking at, first of all, what's the trend in non-OPEC production? It's still going up. And I guess the bears right now, if you read their view of the market, they are looking at another big chunk of oil coming on from the North Sea next fall. That worries them. They think that's going to put downward pressure on oil price. It's showing up only a little bit in the futures market. The prices for next fall contracts are just a few pennies lower than the cash price today. So there aren't many bears out there right now. I will say that. The key issue, of course, for us on the OPEC side has been Iraq. They represent 3 million barrels a day that's been sitting on the sidelines for almost 5 years now. And, they could come back at any time if the conditions were right. But we tend to put them aside because I don't think they will be a factor as long as Saddam Hussein is the president. We feel that, although it's always an issue that's going to be cause for concern to the market. In the longer term, the other key not, I think, I mentioned the UK and the North Sea sector. That's they continue to find more oil there. It continues to be a growth area in the non-OPEC. But the real area of potential continues to be the former Soviet Union and more specifically countries that are in the vicinity of the Middle East, Kazakhstan, primarily, and those areas around the Caspian Black Sea that have traditionally been oil-producing provinces. Very, very attractive geology. There are other very attractive oil provinces in Russia, and I guess the main obstacle to development there really is the distribution system and getting the oil to market, which in this case is extremely complicated because of the political turmoil and issues of ownership and sovereignty and who gets to do what when. But in the long term, this represents a huge amount of oil that can come on the market. It just occurred to me that, how I said in terms of what we've done with the North Slope production, we sort of took a curve like this and dropped it up front and bumped it up out there. In a way, that's sort of like what Iraq is right now. I mean, every day that Iraq's not producing 3 million barrels a day is a day where they can be producing 3 million barrels a day in the future. In other words, they're banking 90 to 100 billion barrels of reserves as we speak, and those barrels will be available at some time in the future. So when you add all this up, where do we come down in terms of a long-term oil price forecast? Pretty much to echo Commissioner Condon's comments about the price moving between the high and the low, we feel that the central tendency is still probably something very close to the $16.50 a dollar a barrel level. If you look in detail at our numbers, we do assume that that over time that the price of oil will in that mid case will kind of keep up with inflation, so that if plus or minus we'd be very close to $16.50 per barrel purchasing power in the year 2005, for instance. I would like to just emphasize, however, that for planning purposes, some of the corporation oil companies actually do focus on what we call the low scenario, and that's the scenario for $15 oil.
frankly, this is it's hard to sell this scenario in today's environment with $18 oil prices, but as a matter of fact, there are, I think that is something to always think about, because we've seen prices go that way, the same sort of market dynamics that move prices down that way in that direction can always occur, just as right now the market dynamic is pushing oil up to the $18 a barrel level. The other thing I wanted to say about the high scenario, and that is the acid test on that, I believe, is look back to back to 1986, when sort of the so-called market paradigm swept over the oil market, and we've really had a market determined price rather than countries like OPEC trying to impose a price on the market. We've had years with $18 a barrel oil. I mean, many of the people in this room remember those years. They were good years, but they were not strung together. What an $18 a barrel year could be followed by a $13.97 a barrel year as well. So just trying to emphasize for you again the volatility and hopefully make a pitch for a long-term planning price that's probably somewhere close to the middle, and $16.50, I guess, is where we come down. Let's move from oil prices, though. I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the variables in our forecast that don't get a lot of discussion. I think a lot of people think that, it's all the sales price of oil, and you can watch that. And yes, you can watch the sales price of oil and get a pretty good idea of where revenues are going, but I think it's important to realize that we have some fairly big deductions from that sales price to come up with the wellhead value, which is what we do tax and what we get our royalties on. The graph that is on this next page of transportation costs, the lower 48, rolls together both the TAPS pipeline charge and the tankers. The main thing I'd like to point out is that in fiscal 95, we had a big jump in the cost of moving our oil to market. And this is like average to all markets, so it includes Gulf Coast as well as West Coast destinations. A big chunk of this, the biggest chunk of this, was the result of the 1995 TAPS filing. Once again, there were what we call unanticipated operating expenses, hundreds of millions of dollars that were expended by Alyeska for things like the electrical work and corrosion repair and a number of other expenses. This caused the tariff to go up by almost 50 cents a barrel higher than what we had anticipated it would be, simply because we had no way of anticipating what those additional operating expenses are. The other thing was the on the marine cost side. As I recall, it's sort of off the top of my head, but I believe our marine cost assumption went up about 15, 20 cents a barrel. Most of that cost is a function of the increased OPA 90 type regulatory costs, which are basically showing up in the costs that we allow for deduction on the severance tax side. Just to break the pipeline out, I know some people will have an interest in the TAPS tariff. On the next chart, if you'll notice in this curve, we sort of bottom out in fiscal. Actually, that tanker and pipeline costs go down between 1995 and 1998. Mostly, that's on the tanker side, that's a function of the fact that fewer and fewer barrels of our oil are going to be going to the Gulf Coast. So we can drop a whole big chunk of that extra transportation cost, and so the average transportation cost is going to drop. The second thing is the TAPS tariff, and this graph that shows the TAPS tariff and its components illustrates pretty well what we think will be happening. And I would direct your attention primarily to the to two things. One is the depreciation, which is sort of the second box up on each one of the bars. And you can see that because the original capital cost of the construction of the pipeline is depreciating away, that
that box begins to shrink. You'll notice, however, it does start to grow again out beyond the year 2000, and that's simply because in our model we have built in new capital investment that will be subject to a new set of depreciation. The other thing is you'll notice that there is some decline in operating costs. Part of that, our operating cost assumptions are driven by two things. One, we have a certain amount of your operating expenses are going to be associated with the number of barrels. The more barrels you shift, the higher costs that you would have. The more fuel you have to run through pump stations, the less barrels, the less you have to use, you have to burn. The second thing are the fixed operating expenses. As production throughput in the taps goes down, you've already, I'm sure, are very well familiar with the announcement that they're talking very seriously about closing the pump station outside of Fairbanks. There will be decommissioning of facilities, and that will lower the fixed costs. So what we hope to see is this profile that I've outlined for you, which is sort of a kind of a U-shaped transportation cost. We hope that it's going to drop over time, that we should be able over the next 5-6 years to enjoy transportation costs of somewhere between 4 and 5, hopefully below 450 a barrel, to move our oil off the slope and into lower 48 markets. The last chart I wanted to walk through with you is the I thought I'd draw everybody's attention back to the good old Alaska State Revenue Matrix that we generate with each forecast. Because this is the sort of you pick 'em forecast table and schedule. I guess the one that you might want to, if you wanted to play the game, let's just play the game by saying let's look at $18 a barrel and go down that ANS lower 48 price at 18, and then let's just pick 1.5. That is our current estimate of fiscal 96 production. And the number you get, if you go to where those two, the row and column converge, is 1.948. That gives you a rough idea of where, if you were to plug in today's prices and our estimated production for next year, that's about where we would be. Now, that number there would be just about a little less than 200 million higher than the current base case. So as we go forward into fiscal 96, we'll continue to produce this little matrix so you can make your best. I think what it does is it gives you the opportunity to see sort of where we are today and what if the current situation went for the entire year. Or maybe you had some other gut feeling about oil prices or even oil production. It does give you the alternative of looking at the revenue possibilities. That's basically the presentation I had for today. I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you might have about the forecast or oil prices or anything like that.
I've got just one question, and then Representative Martin, I believe, has a question as well. On the production levels you're assuming for 96, what is the range of production levels your three estimates go from? I mean, you're assuming 1.5 million barrels a day in the base case. What's the low and what's the high?
Actually, on the production side, we have a single point estimate for production for the short term.
So for the year that's starting in July, your estimate is all based on 1.5 million barrels a day?
Yes, it is.
It just seems strange that when that was a big component of the last error, that we're showing no spread in potential in that area, that's all.
I agree. It's one of the reasons we put together the sensitivity matrix. Just from a technical point of view, if you add a whole other level of complexity, if you begin to, because technically our high, low, and mid scenarios are high, low, and mid price, because everything in our model is run off of that key variable. You know, I mean, I happen to agree that, I've talked with the petroleum engineer about, you know, well, can you give me a feeling for the technical risk here? Not price risk, but the technical risk. What sort of parameters? And we've kicked it around. The problem is, it's kind of like if you had a high, low, and mid production and high, low, and mid price, you'd you'd increase the number of possible scenarios to, I never was good at probability or combinations, but something like six, I guess, or what is it, three things taken two at a time? Or anyway, you do increase the number of total possibilities, maybe it's as many as nine. Yeah, I was just thinking that maybe you'd have a redundancy there. No, I think it's nine, yeah. That's the main reason, Senator. Anyway, we're hopefully the matrix would accommodate the concern about that.
So that part we can guess ourselves.
Yeah, you can believe the confident engineers.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Senator. That's the main thing I'm going to get on, because I kind of think that our welfare is dependent more on production nowadays than it is on the oil prices, although the oil price is important. It's just a production. And it seems to me that is there not a better way to, instead of just using the Ouija board here, to get information from the producers as to, especially when we're injecting oil, water and gas, and then, of course, part of that comes back with oil. Isn't there a determination, if I remember, we were able to tell per well what increase of oil and what water and what increase of gas was coming through as we pushed through the oil? And could that not give us an idea of how many wells may have to be shut down, at what point there's completely no profitability for the oil company to us? And then with that in mind, as you look across your Ouija board, I would go from right to left. At first, I took a 1.55 as the production for this year, but you said it's 1.5, and shouldn't be going to the left. I'm basically trying to get to a thing that Senator Halford said a year or two ago, that perhaps we should do better with a five-year average, not only on price but on production, and especially when we know production is going down. So with the technical authorities that we have, it shouldn't be a guessing game. Not all the factors, but at least what's coming out well. And the decrease in oil per, compared to gas and water, Steve.
If I might, like to answer that, Representative Martin. With respect to the production volume forecasting, the person that's responsible for doing this work for the the Department of Revenue, in fact, does carefully go through all of the development plans that each of the operators has put together and filed with the state for all of the fields on the North Slope, and reviewed with the pertinent companies the production forecast. So it really isn't a guessing game that one person engages in. It is an evaluation of the plans for the next few years of each of the companies with respect to each of the fields, and a review with the operating companies of the judgments that folks have made about what's going to happen. And so it is the best we can do in terms of going and talking to the people who are responsible for investing the money and trying to get the hydrocarbons out of the ground.
Have we gotten to the point, sir, if I may, where we can tell, looking at Poudre Bay, because that's the main thing, the mother load, if that's not working, I don't know how much production we need from new areas to make up. But are we at the point now where maybe some wells are being shut down because they're not producing profitably, or what's the word there? I don't even know how many wells we have producing at Poudre Bay.
The answer to that question is yes, there are not wells being shut down because they are not producing profitably, but there are wells that are being shut down because in the mix of oil and gas production it's not optimum to produce out of particular wells because of the high amount of gas that is produced with the oil.
That's because of injection. That we're trying to push.
Well, you know, there's the facilities at Prudhoe Bay can only handle so much gas, and as the field matures, the amount of gas produced per barrel of oil increases daily. And the amount of oil that can be produced is a function of the ability to handle the gas that comes out of the ground with the oil.
On a question, then can we determine that we will have a production loss of maybe 3%, 4% per year for the next how many years?
Every year there will be some production loss, and determine is probably too strong a verb. We can make a judgment and run that judgment by the people who are running the field and see whether they agree with that judgment, and that's the process we use to come up with that estimate.
Would that not be the final line for us to say what our budget should be for the next 3 or 4 years forecast? Looking at your Ouija board going backwards, shouldn't that tell us?
Well, I to return to the point I made in my brief opening comment, Representative, I believe that one should look at and anticipate the range between the low case and the high case, and if we add have some good years. Nevertheless, we should realize there are going to be some bad years, and picking the right mid case over the longer term is the way I believe the state ought to be doing its budget planning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chuck, you made reference to the Cambridge report, and what they talked about quite a bit was the prospect before the year 2000 of opening Badami and what they called the String of Pearls fields that mm-hmm. are between, say, Prudhoe Bay and the going east. Is what, if anything, do you have in this forecast for production on any of those fields? And if you've studied the report, what is your difference in your forecasts? You mentioned Milne Point, and then you talked about the Kuparuk enhanced recovery and the more wells in Prudhoe Bay. Now, what are the components of your forecast compared to theirs that make up the fairly large discrepancy in their forecast? You must be 300,000 or 400,000 barrels a day apart by 1998 or 1999.
I think we're pretty close, actually, Senator. Through 2002, I don't have the chart in front of me, but
maybe
we did.
It's farther out. But you know
farther out it is, because okay. they have this concept of liquid production capacity that they is what they label their the barrels axis, which yeah, we've not been able to nail that down. But let me address yeah. your first question, and that is. We have not actually explicitly included production from Badami. Now, this is a very exciting prospect. We opted not to do this for a couple of reasons, but mostly because at this point it really hasn't been delineated to the point where I think if we waited for a few months or so, we'd get a better idea, because they will be doing some delineation work, is my understanding, and so at least we'd have a better idea on how many barrels are there. With respect to some of the other things that Cambridge mentions in their report, some of them are sort of a mystery to us. We haven't really assumed anything from places like Hammerhead and some of these other wells that were drilled, but we do have in our forecast the ability to produce the North Star unit, or Seal Island, another one of these offshore discoveries. We do have in our forecast the West Sac Sands, for instance. We have a number of those kinds of fields that, if the price were right, now, it's a guessing game on the cost side. For these fields, clearly they're not being produced now because they're of very large cost hurdles. In terms of anything offshore, we're talking about very expensive, under current technology, very expensive undersea pipelines in areas with high scouring, and just the distance and the logistical costs of drilling wells where you have a very seasonal drilling schedule and the need for some sort of production facility offshore. What's happening in the technological area is very exciting, however. It may be. Reading the Alaska report, they're talking, BP's been drilling wells
deviated wells that are going out miles, so that it may be, as technology improves over time, that they may be doing some fantastic things that they're not able to do right now, given current technology, and producing fields and reducing the costs. So, I'm going on and on here, but the main difference between us is I don't know where they get all these barrels out there. We don't have in our set of reservoirs or known discoveries any. We don't have enough barrels to justify that production uptick. And they may know something we don't.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Riggle, just let me make clear, though, what our relative production volume forecasts are. Through 2002, the Department of Revenue's forecast is higher, not by much, but consistently higher out through 2002 than the Cambridge projection that you saw the other day. The Department of Revenue does not have any production from Badami included in the forecast out through that time period, and that very well may come to pass. Our forecast, and Cambridge does forecast that, but our forecast for the Prudhoe Bay production and Kuparuk production is higher. Then when you get to 2002, that is the time at which Cambridge picks up two chunks, and that is known fields that they put in their forecast that no development plans have been announced for, and as well some new discoveries that obviously haven't occurred. And that's where the volumes diverge. The Department of Revenue's forecast continues to decline, and Cambridge takes a sharp kick up.
Okay, just one quick thought. On the known field side, is it new, currently non-producing known fields, or is it more recovery out of existing producing fields today?
The former production out of known fields for which no development plans have been announced.
That's correct.
But for producing fields, I think not without exception, but almost without exception, our forecast is more optimistic than theirs.
Speaker Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chuck, have you requested a detailed report from Cambridge as to the increase in those numbers on the years far out? I mean, have they given you any of that information?
We've requested it. We've gotten the actual numbers, but I have not, to this date, received any backup or assumptions that underlie the sort of the total number.
Mr. Chairman, I think that'd be worthwhile for us to try to get a hold of.
They probably charge us for it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nothing.
Senator Sharp.
I apologize if this question's already been asked while I was absent, but you did talk, I guess, about the TAPS tariff components. And when you look at the TAPS tariff component compared to the total transportation cost graph, I guess it looks like between now and 98, TAP goes down about, 60 cents or so. But the other goes down $1.50 or more. So there's 90 cents drop on tanker cost to get it. Is that because less is going to the Gulf or none's going to the Gulf? Or
yes.
After that time?
Yes. Yes.
So why the big bubble on the increase in tariff from 94 to 95?
Most of that was, there are two things. The biggest was when they filed for the 95 tariff, it was our first look at their actual operating expenses and other costs that they file under the tariff. And as it turned out, those costs were much higher than the ones that we had, or at least they filed. What their anticipated costs went up from their anticipated costs that they filed in 94. And that's the primary reason. There was also, I thought there was a small carry forward, but most of it was higher operating expenses than we had anticipated that they would file. And we do receive there is a reconciliation done by our TAPS attorneys in Washington
that breaks that down. But that would be something that the Attorney General would has available. I don't have that with me today.
Because it looks like the difference, just trying to interpret the graphs, is close to $550 million increase. Take it times 540 million barrels, 550 pass through. I don't know.
Well, you know, we don't absorb the entire blow. Our take at the wellhead would be about 25% of every dollar increase in cost. So we'd pay a quarter of every dollar increase in cost through lower wellhead value and lower severance tax and royalties.
True, but the total cost is
the total cost, yes.
$550 million in 1 year.
Actually, I think the number that was plugged in, off the top of my head, it seems to me it was about an additional $350 million and maybe as much as $400 million in what we've come to call as unanticipated, but it seems like to a certain extent recurring increased operating expenditures, and most of those are related to the fact that the pipeline is getting old, and there are a lot of repairs that have had to be undertaken that, in a perfect world, could have been avoided or would not have occurred, but have to be done to keep the system whole.
Senator Rieger, and then we're going to go on to the bill schedule.
No, that's fine. I was just going to point out, I did get some feedback from Cambridge, follow up some questions, and just digging up the letter, but I think that they were saying that they identified three areas. I think it was Covelum, our complex, or whatever, and one other, and each they said would be 150 to 300 million barrels in reserves. Bob's question. It wasn't a production question, it was a reserves question.
If there's no further questions, I just have one last thing. I don't know whether they teach it in projection school or what it is, but every time we get a downturn in the short term, we always show an upturn in the long term. I think that must be that you have to give us the reality now, but you want to add a little hope to the end of the projection where it doesn't matter much.
Well, it's kind of like gold fever, I think. You know, you get some of these oil guys talking about the potential of Alaska. They get excited about it. And if we could just get that fever to expand everywhere, we could get some people in here investing more money.
Whenever we have a downturn, we always seem to have a little tail on the end that gives a little hope. Thank you very much. We're going to break for 5 minutes and come back on the committee bill schedule, which will be 1:32.